Welcome to the University of Wisconsin Foundation, Bascom Hill Society Showcase Series podcast, featuring some of the University of Wisconsin's best and brightest faculty and staff. This installment features Alta Charo, the Warren P. Knowles Professor of Law and Bioethics at the University of Wisconsin-Madison Law School.
Good afternoon. It's a pleasure to see all of you today on, dare I say, the spring-like day today. My name is Susan Chesky. I'm the Director of Stewardship at the UW Foundation. And right now it's my pleasure to introduce Professor John Kidwell, who will then introduce our speaker. Professor Kidwell was born in Denver, Colorado. He grew up in Custer, South Dakota. After high school, he attended the South Dakota School of Mines and Technology for 2 years, contemplating a degree in physics, but he relates that he changed his plans when he encountered the calculus and the calculus form. He transferred to the University of Iowa and majored in English, receiving a BA from the University of Iowa in 1967. He then attended Harvard Law School and received his JD in 1970. Professor Kidwell joined the University of Wisconsin Law Faculty in 1972 as an assistant professor and except for a year as a fellow in Law and Humanities at Harvard University in the 70s. He has been here continuously. He served as Associate Dean for Academic Affairs from 2002 to 2005, and he retired from the full-time faculty in June of 2005. So with that, I welcome Professor Kidwell.
Thanks very much for that very generous introduction. I've got some bad news and some good news. The bad news is that the dean of the law school, Ken Davis, wasn't able to be here today to introduce one of his favorite colleagues, Professor Charo. The good news is that this meant that I got to pinch hit for him. And I've never had an uninteresting conversation with Alta Charo, and I always look forward to hearing your talk. The bad news is that there isn't nearly enough time to adequately introduce her. She's the Warren Knowles Professor of Law and Bioethics, and she holds appointments on the faculty of the law school, in the medical school department of medical history and bioethics, in the Master's in Biotechnology Studies program, and she also lectures in the Department of Population Health Sciences. Her CV is 13 pages long in 10-point Times New Roman font. She's been a visiting professor in Argentina, Australia, Canada, China, Cuba, France, Germany, New Zealand, Virginia, Florida, and California. Those last three might or may not be foreign countries. In 2006, she was elected to membership in the National Academy's Institute of Medicine. She has 100 publications and serves on the editorial board of 4 journals. She has served on President Clinton's National Bioethics Advisory Commission and any number of nationally significant health and medicine advisory committees. In 2006, she was appointed the co-chair of the National Academy's Human Embryonic Stem Cell Research Advisory Committee. She's equally active on campus and in the state of Wisconsin. All this while, finding time to read all the Harry Potter books, renovate her home, hang out at the Shorewood Pool, and teach 10 different courses at the law school. The good news, I'm not going to cut any further into all this time, and I'm not going to try to summarize her talk. The bad news, when she is done talking, you will all wish you could spend the rest of the afternoon with her. So I give you my favorite colleague, Alta Charo.
What John failed to tell you is that he and I are joined at the hip by one very strong mutual interest, and that is Texas Hold'em poker. And what he also failed to tell you is that he has beaten me every single time that we have played Texas Hold'em poker. So the truly impressive person in this room is my favorite colleague, Professor John Kidwell. I'd like to spend some time with you today talking about stem cell research here in Wisconsin and around the world, but to talk about it in a way that gets beyond the talks that you have, I am sure, heard already concerning the moral status of the embryo, the politics around embryo research, and the dilemmas that has posed for federal financing and the future of the field here at UW and elsewhere. I'd like to talk with you about where the field might be going next and how the politics will remain complicated. It will remain challenging to our very notions of the role of government in America. To do that, though, I do need to back up just a little bit to remind you of some of the more classic applications and classic areas of controversy, just in order to highlight the ways in which the alternative methods being developed now may change the nature of the debate. I think everybody here is familiar with the outlines of the classic form of embryonic stem cell research pioneered by Jamie Thompson here at UW, in which embryos that are left over after IVF procedures and which are slated to be discarded are instead diverted to research in which the inner cell lining or inner cell mass of those embryos is removed and then manipulated to create these really quite almost magical cell lines that can replicate and replicate without going through the process of sequential specialization into the different parts of our body, and now become this incredible tool by which we can manipulate them to specialize however we wish. And of course, I'm sure you're familiar with the area of application that people have speculated about most passionately, and that is tissue transplantation. Growing in a laboratory dish the tissue you need to substitute for the skin that was burned over 80% of your body in some horrific accident, or to replace the heart muscle that was lost when oxygen was deprived during a heart attack, or to substitute for the area of the brain that was damaged or diseased that causes you to have Parkinsonian type symptoms. And certainly that is one area of application that we are all hoping to see and hoping to see sooner rather than later. It is, however, an application that already is beginning to pose some challenges. For example, if you were to set up an ideal system for identifying which diseases or injuries we would treat first with a completely innovative and therefore quite risky medical therapy, you might say, what are those conditions in which the prognosis is grim or even hopeless, and the quality of life is poor for the moment, and say in those cases we might say it's worth taking the risk with this particularly risky innovation. Mm-hmm. And so you might look at things like Lou Gehrig's disease, for example, probably on my top 10 list of most horrific ways for somebody to get ill and die. But instead, what we're seeing is a rush to clinical application so that, for example, Geron, one of our original partners in the funding of Jamie's work, has for the last 3 years every year announced that this year it is going to begin clinical trials on a tissue replacement therapy for spinal cord injury. This is the Christopher Reeve dream before he passed away. This is the dream that those who are using wheelchairs can walk again. And yet, although we can be incredibly excited about the prospect of something that can restore the ability to walk to the young people who lose this ability in terrible diving accidents or the veterans that come home with injuries from explosive devices, looked at another way, it's a very problematic place to begin this clinical intervention. After all, somebody with a spinal cord injury has a long life expectancy. They have, after an initial period of very difficult adjustment, a prospect of a quite reasonably good quality of life with marriage and children and career in a wheelchair. Admittedly in a wheelchair, but this is not the same thing as a terminal illness with no prospect of any kind of happiness between now and the end of life. In addition, with spinal cord injuries, the very first days and weeks after the injury are often crucial for the use of those therapies that we do now have in order to maintain whatever function can be preserved in the spinal cord. And yet, this is also exactly the same period of time at which you would need to begin introducing these clinical therapies like tissue transplant. And so, not only do these people have the prospect of a reasonable, although difficult, life with standard therapy, but it would be difficult to construct a trial in which you have the stem cell innovation therapy at the same time that you also offer the standard therapy. So people really are risking every possible preservation of function or gain in function that they might otherwise have. And then, as if to make it even more complicated, we like to think that people are independent, autonomous beings who can make decisions for themselves and can be given the choice of whether or not they wish to be part of an experimental trial of this innovative therapy. And yet, what possible moment could be worse to ask somebody to make a sober and reasoned decision in light of significant uncertainty, complicated medical information, and mathematically complex odds than the moment after which they've had a devastating, traumatic, acute accident that has left them suddenly profoundly depressed and frightened? I think with this, you begin to appreciate that the move from laboratory to therapy is not a trivial move, no matter how much we want it to happen quickly. So one of the challenges in this area, even using what we now think of as classic embryonic stem cell therapy, one of the challenges is to manage public expectations and to manage patient expectations. Already, all over the country and all over the world, people with illnesses and their family members are calling the laboratories, calling the physicians, calling the fly-by-night companies with their fly-by-night websites, asking where they can get stem cell therapy. Already, all around the world, with a particular emphasis, interestingly, on the Ukraine and to some extent Nigeria, we are seeing websites pop up promising stem cell therapy for everything from Lou Gehrig's disease to wrinkled skin. Seriously. Stem cell therapy is being sold as the next Botox. And we have websites. I did not do PowerPoint because it's too nice a day to have to dim the lights for PowerPoint, but there are websites where they put up what seem to be papers from the most respected medical journals in America, the New England Journal of Medicine, the Journal of the American Medical Association, that are confirming the success of these therapies, and when you actually go and look for these papers, it turns out that they don't exist, and that these are wholly an imaginary illustration that has been created by the owners of the website. So we have now a situation where our public and our patients particularly are being given more and more information in the newspapers about every incremental advance in the field, each time with some hint in the coverage that now is the moment that it's about to happen. We have companies that are constantly making announcements that they are about to enter clinical trials, Geron being one example. And we have the fraudulent websites already going up to try and drag these people in. And you have the political backlash against embryonic stem cell research based on the assertion that to date it has never cured anybody. So that it becomes difficult to say, that's right, it has never cured anybody and we don't want it to, because you have to move into clinical trials in a much more measured way with very small patient populations made up of people for whom the risks and benefits are properly balanced and who are willing to be studied so that we can make the next group of patients become a little bit less at risk for the complications of the therapy. But that's just embryonic stem cell research. That's just where we are today with the classic methods. In the last 3 months, we've had several very high-profile announcements that are going to take this out of the field of embryonic stem cell research and into a field of research of embryonic stem cell equivalent research. One of the first announcements came out of a company that already has a bit of a tainted reputation for making its scientific revelations in newspapers and press releases rather than in scientific and medical journals, and that's Advanced Cell Technologies in Massachusetts. Nonetheless, this does seem to be a paper that is real, And it is something called the Lanza method after the person who pioneered it. Basically, Robert Lanza has figured out that we can take a procedure that we do already in laboratories in the United States for clinical purposes and turn it to our advantage in developing embryonic stem cell lines. Maybe some of you here have relatives who've gone through something called PGD, pre-implantation genetic diagnosis. It's not very common, but for couples who have a significant genetic disorder in the family and who are very fearful of passing this on to their children, one of the options now available to them is to have their embryos made through in vitro fertilization, fertilizing in a laboratory dish as opposed to fertilizing in the body following intercourse. And then once the embryos are in a laboratory dish, we can actually diagnose which ones have the genetic mutation that you fear and which ones are free of it. The way you do it is literally by plucking out one of the cells from the embryo. So you know you go from fertilized egg and then it doubles to 2, then doubles to 4, then doubles to 8, and so on, doubling over the first few days of development. And at the time that you have about 6,428 cells, it is possible to take one of those cells off the embryo and leave the embryo intact otherwise, and it will develop normally toward birth if put back into a woman's body. But the single cell that you've plucked out, you can use to diagnose what kinds of genetic characteristics are present. And this is the way you can decide to use some embryos and not others, pre-implantation genetic diagnosis. So what Lanza figured out how to do is to take that single cell that was already being plucked out for clinical diagnosis and let it develop for one day, let it double into 2 cells, and now use one of them for the diagnosis that the patient has asked for, but use the other one as the source of a kind of starter material that would ultimately lead to an embryonic stem cell line. So here's a way to get an embryonic stem cell line from an embryo without destroying the embryo, which would seem to be the techno fix to all of our moral dilemmas, right? Now, we can literally have our cake and eat it too. We can have our embryo left intact. Nobody has to destroy it. And at the same time, we can get the embryonic stem cell lines that we so desperately want. And as soon as this was announced, the speculation was that this would be the answer to all of our political problems and that the White House would immediately respond by saying, fantastic, we will fund this fully, even though we've up until now been very restrictive in our funding approach to ESL research. That would have been overly optimistic, because the fact that this involved the diagnosis of an embryo, the fact that this was associated with couples making decisions about which embryos to bring to term and which ones not, meant that, interestingly, from a political standpoint, it was unacceptable for both the right wing and the left wing, and here they came together to oppose it. Why? Seriously, this is a field that's characterized by having no simple divisions between left and right, because here is a field in which far right and far left tend to merge for different reasons in opposition to these techniques. So for people who are on the, kind of right end of the spectrum, who are typically very much uncomfortable with abortion and with the disruption of fetal life or embryonic life, anything that seems to somehow make one complicit in the decision to not use certain embryos is unacceptable. So federal funding of a research technique that takes advantage of the fact that parents are not going to, in fact, use all their embryos is simply unacceptable. It makes them connected and complicit with this underlying act of which they disapprove. So for those who oppose abortion on moral grounds, often there was opposition to taking advantage of PGD, even though the embryo is not destroyed, because the whole process of diagnosis began with an intent to maybe not use all of your embryos. That leaves the left. Well, the left in the United States has become very much attached to the question of how we can ensure equality in society, and one of the groups they worry about are those with disabilities. And others are, the other groups that they worry about tend to be those that are impoverished. Now, PGD is aimed at couples who want to avoid the birth of a child with a significant genetic disorder. Some of those disorders are incompatible with life itself. They're lethal. But others are associated with significant forms of disability, but they're not associated with being lethal. And so any technique that, in some sense, is approving of or tolerant of parents making the decision to avoid the birth of a child with disabilities is suggestive of a degree of intolerance of those with disabilities, and that itself is very problematic. Right? I see people shaking their heads, and yet, of course, we recognize in terms of the realities of political life that the disability rights movement is very new and its successes are very fresh, and they are hard fought and hard won. The fact that people can now get around campus to the extent that they can, that they can participate in civic life to the extent that they can, is a huge change from my childhood and your childhoods, when people who used wheelchairs, people who were blind, people who were deaf, became isolated in their own homes and essentially were outcasts of society. This is something we should celebrate. And yet, to the extent that whether through government programming and research or through individual decisions, we encourage or at least facilitate the decision to avoid bringing any new people into the world with disabilities, we are, in fact, first of all, we are, you know, kind of reinforcing the commonly held notion that this is not a good thing even if you have to live with it. And second, we in fact reduce the numbers of people who have these conditions, and with reduced numbers comes reduced political power. And you may not find this persuasive, but I do offer it to you so that you will understand the source of opposition. So that from the far left and the far right, opposition to PGD meant that there really was no support for diverting funding from the federal government to this new technique for generating embryonic stem cells, even though it seemed like the perfect fix to all of our moral dilemmas, right? So that went by the board when President Bush's representative said that clearly no money was going to be spent on this. Now, the next thing that happened that was a very big deal is something that happened simultaneously here in Wisconsin and in Japan. You are all familiar, I suspect, with the phenomenon of cloning, right? This is the famous Dolly experiment, where you take a cell, a regular cell from some adult part of the body, and you will take cytoplasm, essentially the egg white of the egg, right? You take cytoplasm from an egg, and you fuse it with this cell, and somehow it will rejuvenate this cell. So a cell that thought that it was skin, suddenly in the presence of cytoplasm from an egg, thinks, oh, I'm a fertilized egg. It gets all confused, and now it's all ready to do what a fertilized egg does, which is to begin the process of division and specialization all afresh. It's an inefficient process. There are some biological obstacles that may never be overcome, but it has succeeded in a variety of mammalian species, Dolly being the first one. I'm sure that those of you who heard me speak before have probably heard this, but there may be a few that haven't. Do people here know why Dolly the sheep was named Dolly? I hear a couple of titters. Some people know. So, Dolly the sheep was cloned from a cell taken from the mammary gland of an adult sheep. And the resulting clone was named after Dolly Parton. And I promise you that you will forget everything I said today except that one fact. And I encourage you to share it in your dinner conversations. You will become the hit of your neighborhood. So the concept with cloning, right? The concept with cloning is that we can make an organism whose nuclear genetic material is the same as mine. Whatever it is in my nuclear genetic material that codes for me being short, having curly hair, having flat feet, all those desirable characteristics would come through in my clone, right? Modified by a different environment, but to the extent that these are traits that are fairly what we would call penetrant, they will be reflected in my clone. And there is a fair amount of agreement that doing this for reproductive purposes, to have a child who would have my flat feet and my curly hair and my short stature, is probably not a good idea. Some people object to it because they think there's something wrong about the genetic, about the genealogical bewilderment that would accompany having a child who's technically speaking on a genetic level my sister. Other people think that there's something simply wrong about using a technique that's associated with such a high rate of birth defects and miscarriages in the animal kingdom in order to try for human reproduction. But cloning has another application that has nothing to do with making babies, but does have something to do with making embryos. And that is, if you stop that Dolly experiment before gestation, you clone a cell from me, and you develop it just long enough to make a very early embryo that is capable of giving us a stem cell line, well, then what we've done is we've created a laboratory tool in which people who have genetic disorders can have those genetic disorders essentially replicated in a laboratory dish. You want to study somebody who's got the BRCA1 mutation that codes for early onset breast and ovarian cancer? Let's code a cell from somebody with that disease, and now we can have a laboratory model of tissue that is prone to this particular set of cancers, and we can use it to screen drug therapies or just understand the mechanism by which this mutation leads to cancer. Or maybe take people whose diseases don't have a known genetic mutation. We know that there's a family history pattern. We know that it interacts with the environment. We can't quite tease it apart. And therefore, what we do is we clone cells from their bodies. And again, we create laboratory tools where we can try to tease apart the relative contributions of environment and specific areas of the genome, and therefore try and begin to figure out how to find the genetic target that could become the basis of a drug discovery process. This is the point of cloning, not to make babies, but to combine cloning with stem cell techniques in order to create customized stem cell lines that can be used as research tools in the laboratory. But you notice that along the way, there is this step of creating an embryo. And without saying more, you can imagine all the objections to a technique that makes an embryo solely so that you can destroy it in the process of doing research on it. Right? So this was a technique that attracted not only the usual kind of opposition, but even among people who were supportive of embryonic stem cell therapy using leftover embryos from IVF clinics, we began to find objections to the notion of making an embryo just to destroy it. Even people sympathetic to science would go, I'm not sure about this. And indeed, if you go back to 2001, 2002, 2003, you will find that the U.S. House of Representatives twice voted to criminalize this area of research. That the Senate sat on bills each of those 3 years to criminalize this research, and that over half a dozen states around the U.S. proceeded on the state level to criminalize this research. It's why I used to give talks around the country called From Stem Cells to Jail Cells to talk about the experience of scientists in this particular area of research. Right? Well, in November of 2007, Jamie Thompson here at UW and Shinya Yamanaka in Japan both came out with papers that described a way to functionally obtain the same kind of advantages that we seek from cloning, but without having to go through the stage of creating an embryo. What they figured out how to do is to take an ordinary cell, for example, a cell from my skin, right, and to manipulate it with genetic engineering, with the insertion of specific factors that would essentially despecialize that cell. So every cell in my body has all the same genes as every other cell. The question is which genes are turned on and which ones are turned off. It's like every cell has the same set of piano keys, but each cell is playing a different chord, and only some keys are actually creating music. And once specialized, they usually stay in that position. So my skin cells always play the chord of skin and never anything else. And what they figured out how to do in Wisconsin and Japan was to use genetic engineering to move this cell back to its original kind of blank slate, its state in which we don't know what chord it's going to play, we don't know which keys on the piano will be pressed, and now to re-specialize it along whatever lines you want. So that now you could take my skin cell and then re-specialize it along the lines of neurological tissue or along the lines of blood-related tissues. This would allow you to take a cell, move it backward in specialization, and then forward in specialization without ever going through an intermediate step in which it is an embryo. Again, seemingly the answer to all of our prayers, right? Because now we can get all the advantages of cloning without having to go through the step of making embryos and then destroying them. This, too, is exciting. It's incredible, and it may yet turn out to be the most efficient way to pursue this research, but it, too, has its problems. For one thing, When it comes to eventually using the resulting cell lines for transplant, this is now Christopher Reeve fantasy writ large. That is, we now are not only going to transplant spinal cord tissue, but it's going to be perfectly matched, so there's no possibility of immune rejection like you get with organ donation. So I've just had my diving accident. I'm now paralyzed. And so the fantasy was you take one of my skin cells, and now you use this technique called induced pluripotent stem cells, or IPS, and you would now create a cell line that is exactly the same genetic makeup as me, so my body doesn't reject it, and you reimplant it in my spinal cord, and voila, I am now going to be able to walk again, right? But the genetic engineering technique that you need to use in order to manipulate the stem cell is one that is not without its own risks. Because the way we do genetic engineering is we fool the cells. We have the Trojan horse technique. We take viruses, which are incredibly talented at penetrating our cells and our cell nuclei and hijacking the genetic machinery of our cells in order to replicate and replicate and replicate themselves, right? This is why viruses are so insidious. We use them as the outer packaging for the genes that we want to insert in the genetic engineering experiment. And so what happens is we take the virus, we put in the genes that we want to insert, and then we let the virus loose into the cells it's supposed to penetrate. And once it does, it will insert the gene we're trying to get in there, hopefully in the right place, not always. And then hopefully the cell's machinery will begin to replicate, and our gene is now inserted. In that process, we have lots of risks. Risks that the gene we want to insert will go into the wrong place. Risks that the virus itself, which has this phenomenal capacity for causing replication, will wind up situating itself right next to what's called an oncogene, one of the genes that can actually cause cancer and basically turn it on or turn it up to full volume. And we have seen this when there were gene therapy experiments in France in which there was an attempt to insert normal genes into the bodies of children who had this bubble boy disease, the one in which their immune systems are completely inactive and they're vulnerable to every infection in the world. And it was a great success. They inserted the genes and the immune systems began to work, and these children who were otherwise going to live in complete isolation or die young suddenly looked like they might be able to function in the world. Except that it turned out that the same experiment that treated their autoimmune disease, their immune disease, also gave them leukemia. Now, the leukemia was treatable, so on balance, they did better, but I don't think anybody thinks this is an ideal way to go about dealing with the immune disease. This is my point about the risks of human subjects research. You don't know until you've done it. And in these very early phase one trials, where everything is based on animal data, which can never be a perfect model for humans, you are taking a gamble that you have seen everything in the animal model and that the animal models are an accurate prediction of what will happen in humans, and you can't be sure. So that's one problem with the iPS cells when it comes to actual therapy. But for using them as a research tool, maybe not so bad. Maybe this really is the ticket for the purely laboratory research I described, in which we want to clone cells not to create tissue for transplant, but tissue for drug discovery. And that would be a tremendous step forward if this is more efficient, if it is less controversial than ordinary cloning. It has, however, increased the risk that we will then move on to criminalize cloning research, classic cloning research, and that we will do it enthusiastically. We will do it without concern because, of course, we have now found the alternative, and we do not need to have cloning research around. If you go back to the congressional debates that took place around the time that the House of Representatives voted twice to criminalize cloning research, and if you go back to the discussions in the Senate about whether or not to pass the same bill, you will find over and over that the single most effective argument against criminalizing this research was made by the patient groups who said, you cannot sacrifice our interests in the name of embryos, in the name of public sentiment, in the name of some inchoate concern about morality. We're real, we're here, you can't ignore us. That won the day, at least in the Senate. people like Orrin Hatch, who is profoundly opposed to abortion on a personal level and is happy to legislate against it on a public level, found himself allying himself with Kennedy and Feinstein and others who supported cloning research because, as he himself described it at his press conference, he had constituents that came into his office in wheelchairs saying, "You cannot take away our hope." I remember briefing somebody from the Missouri delegation, also very much opposed to abortion rights, talking about going around her district and seeing parents with diabetic children going, "You cannot take away our hope." The single argument that kept us from criminalizing cloning research was the argument of necessity, that there's nothing else that can accomplish what this research can accomplish. With the advent of IPS, or induced pluripotent stem cell announcements in Japan and Wisconsin, comes the next challenge, and it's the one I'd like to discuss briefly before concluding. And it's the challenge of how we view the role of government vis-a-vis scientific research in America. Because if now for basic drug discovery research, and maybe in the future if you solve the genetic engineering problem for clinical therapy purposes, if you can argue that cloning is no longer absolutely necessary to pursue our more concrete goals, is there any reason why it shouldn't become a need? Why can't we just freely attach a jail sentence to any number of areas of scientific research that threaten us? After all, the objections to cloning also went beyond the concern about embryos. It went to a concern that we were now, quote-unquote, playing God, that we were getting too close to the mystery of the origins of life, that we were manipulating cells at a level that allowed us to create organisms where there's no obvious moment at which the soul had entered the body. When cloning was first announced from the Dolly experiment, people seriously discussed in the newspapers and at conferences whether a child born from cloning would have a soul. The American Bar Association had to actually overtly say a child conceived through cloning and then born would actually be a citizen with full civil rights and not some subhuman special species that doesn't qualify. So in some way, this technique of using a skin cell and infusing it with a substance that allows you to then jumpstart it as if it's a fertilized egg threatens something really profoundly central to our understandings of God, of religion, of spirituality, of consciousness. And in the course of the research that's associated with stem cells, we're going to see other examples of things that are just as profoundly threatening to core values and beliefs. In order to test transplant therapy, at some point, in fact, in some cases already, we have to have experiments where you grow human tissue and transplant it into a non-human animal, just to see if you know how to do the transplant properly, just to see if the material can graft, if it can function, if it can produce the substances it has to produce. But in the process of doing that, you're creating organisms that are part human and part non-human, chimeras, which will be very upsetting to some people. We have seen chimeras created historically, but we have never really seen an opportunity to create chimeras with the degree of mixing that we now can. Take a human embryonic stem cell and stick it into a monkey embryo, and human and monkey material will be fused throughout the body of the resulting organism, its brain as well as its kidneys. What do we know about the nature of that resulting organism? Is it altered or not? We don't know. We've seen exactly that experiment done with human tissue inserted into the brain of a mouse. That was done out in California, and it worried people. And we now have committees that have been set up all over the country and here in UW to try and work through this with our scientists so that experiments proceed slowly, incrementally, with great attention to where it is that our knowledge is limited about what will be the outcome. But these are experiments that go to our notion of the space that humans occupy in the greater animal kingdom, whether we are fundamentally different or part of a continuum, which is very much part of the same debate as we see on evolutionary theory. And in general, all of our work in synthetic biology and the construction of artificial chromosomes which will ultimately and pretty soon probably lead to the ability to take laboratory materials off your shelf and mix and match and ultimately wind up with a multi-celled organism that you've created from stuff in bottles. Aldous Huxley, right? Kind of science. If we feel comfortable criminalizing research because it challenges our very most cherished notions about life and God and the meaning of being human, we are looking at a road in which we may be criminalizing many things. This is historically something we do. Let me read to you very briefly one quote from Goethe, who talked about the experience of Copernicus, who upset everybody's cherished notions about the role of humanity when he upset the notion of us being at the center of all things. Goethe writes about Copernicus, "Of all discoveries and opinions, none may have exerted greater effect on the human spirit than the doctrine of Copernicus. The world had scarcely become known as round and complete in itself when it was asked to waive the tremendous privilege of being the center of the universe. Never, perhaps, was a greater demand made on mankind, for by this admission, so many things vanished in mist and smoke. What became of our Eden, our world of innocence, piety, and poetry, the testimony of the senses, the conviction of a poetic religious faith? No wonder his contemporaries didn't wish to let all this go, and offered every possible resistance to a doctrine which in its converts authorized and demanded a freedom of view and greatness of thought so far unknown, indeed, not even dreamed of." This is the challenge today. As individual citizens in deciding whether the role of government is to criminalize those things that threaten our beliefs, or it is to leave those to the serendipitous developments of science while appropriately regulating to guard against concrete harms to known live people. And it's the challenge of our universities, which are dedicated to a really fearless exploration of science, no matter where it goes and no matter which beliefs it upsets. It is, I think, going to be one of the most difficult and touchy arguments we will have as a society in the coming years as biology gets closer and closer to the core meaning of life. It's an argument we may begin to see even among our presidential candidates, who, although they all support expanded funding for embryonic stem cell research, do divide on the issue of whether we should criminalize or keep legal cloning research. And it is an issue that we may see in our courts if anybody ever gets creative enough to try to argue that the same First Amendment that protects our speech and protects our conduct that communicates a message should also protect scientific research that in and of itself, by its very doing of research, communicates the thought that not all things are so sacred that they may not be questioned. With that, I'd like to thank you for your attention and to invite any questions you may have. Thank you very much. Susan, did you want to moderate questions? Shall I do it from here? Okay, the gentleman from MIT. And UW-Madison.
What has been done in other countries as far as criminalizing this kind of research, and that it's much less? I don't understand the means in terms of leadership.
The situation worldwide is quite varied. And it goes from, I'm sorry, thank you for reminding me. I'm supposed to repeat the question. And it was, what is the situation in other countries and what does it say about leadership for us? The situation around the world is quite varied. By far the most supportive regimes exist in the United Kingdom and Belgium, where they not only maintain the legality of all this research, but they fund all of this research. They also have a fairly robust regulatory system by which they license the facilities where the research goes on. And there are people who've argued that that ought to be a model for us. Certainly, the UK has consistently, since the early 1980s, been the global leader in thinking through issues around embryo research and stem cell biology and in setting guidelines and then regulations in this area in order to allow the research to go forward. At the other end of the spectrum, we have countries where almost all of this research is criminal. Germany, as an example, Germany's got a very special history, and because of the experience with the Nazis, there is extreme nervousness about anything associated with genetics because that seems too close to eugenics. And so Germany's politics is characterized by the Green Movement, opposition to biotechnology in general. Their criminalization is so extreme that not only is it a criminal act to perform most embryo research or stem cell research there, but if a German scientist goes to the United Kingdom where it's perfectly legal and engages in this research, the German scientist is guilty of committing a crime under German law, extraterritorial application of criminal law, which is really quite rare in the world of law. In between, we have many, many countries that have kept work on embryos that are being discarded legal, or at least work on the stem cell lines that somebody else makes from such embryos legal, but they have drawn the line at cloning research. Our neighbor to the north, Canada, is an example. Places like Australia are hard to characterize because, like us, they're federal and each state has its own rules. Other countries are in the midst of moving because they're worried about being left out. So Japan, for example, is in the process of liberalizing. And then you have places like China, where there is a growing amount of research, but nobody really knows how much or where because you don't have the same degree of transparency or regulation. And so it's hard to know exactly what's going on or even what the rules are under which it's going on. Are we losing our position for leadership? I'd say we never had it in some ways. We have, in the world of IVF, we trailed behind Australia. In the world of ethics, we trailed behind the United Kingdom. What we do have is a concentration of talent and a sheer scale of activity that has kept us right up there on top of the world stage. But as a political matter, we have suffered from so many years of non-funding or political paralysis that we are constantly at risk of losing that position.
More of a comment. I heard about a scientist in London who is using stem cells, and this process ought to keep the right wing of the left wing very happy with that, but she's using this to regenerate neural cells in the retina, and she's got some success with that. The stem cells, by the way, are from zebrafish.
So she's using, okay, the comment was that there's somebody in the United Kingdom, did you say?
Yeah.
Who's using stem cells from zebrafish in order to generate neurological tissue for the repair of the human retina? Well, that is fascinating, and I actually have to confess I hadn't heard that. Now, she's actually going to transplant zebrafish material into humans?
That's probably down the road.
Okay. I mean, because she's now doing it with rats, you said.
Right.
The reason I ask is that we have, in the U.S., we have long had some concerns about what's called xenotransplantation, in which you take tissue from one species and put it into another. That's not to say we never do it. There might even be somebody here who's got a pig valve after a heart valve replacement operation. But we don't like to do this all that often because of the fear that a virus that exists in, let's say, the world of pigs, when exposed to the human body, will now undergo a mutation that will create a new form of virus that will be particularly virulent to humans and which will never have been seen before. So our bodies will have no immunological defense against it. So xenotransplant is something that the Food and Drug Administration permits, but tends to be very strict about and looks mostly to situations where there is a manifest necessity, to go back to the argument of necessity, before they will approve it because of public health concerns. I find it fascinating to hear about an area of research in which it might be built specifically upon the prospect of xenotransplantation. So the question, or the point that's being made in the question is, given that in the past much of this stem cell controversy has been driven by public discussion and legislative debate that was rife with misconceptions and misinformation about the science, what would be the right forum in which to now go forward with a better educational effort? So at least, you know, good ethics and good legislation does begin with good facts, right? I don't know that there is a simple answer. I think that the experience of the last 10 years has actually changed the attitude of the scientific community. Many who previously would not have gone near a microphone will now force themselves to do this, even though it's not what they decided they wanted to do with their lives, because they recognize the direct connection between their ability to communicate to the public and their ability to work without fear of prosecution or without a lack of federal funding. If you want to look at models, the Canadians had a royal commission that actually spent several years going up and down the Canadian landscape, holding public meeting after public meeting, each one accompanied by local press coverage, so that there was, over time, a fairly high degree of exposure. But of course, it's a much smaller country than ours, and their media markets are much more concentrated than ours, so that may not be a feasible model. There is the development of model curricula for students, so that at the high school level and in college level, we can actually get information out at least to the next generation of people who will be voting on these things. There are legislative briefings. You know, one of the real losses we have is the loss of the Congressional Office of Technology Assessment. I say this with some bias because that was, you know, one of my earliest jobs, and I have a very warm spot there in my heart for that place. But it functioned as a nonpartisan advisor to Congress. As each new technology appeared on the horizon, the job of the OTA was to create academically respectable and defensible reports that did future casting on the technology and on the social effects it would have, and then to provide a variety of options for congressional action, ranging from do nothing to do many things, but without an ideological slant. That agency was dismantled in the mid-1990s, and nothing has really ever taken its place. The Congressional Research Service does a little bit of this, but they do fast and dirty, six-page reports, turn around a week. The General Accounting Office, I forget what they're called now, they're just making a name change, will do longer pieces, but they tend to have more of a financial auditing approach. The National Academies does some top, you know, phenomenal reports, but it takes 17 years for each one to get out of review. So we don't have a mechanism. It would be interesting, at least at the state level, to experiment with having something like that to at least advise the state legislature in a nonpartisan way, but a timely way, on new technologies and their social implications and the options for action.
I was struck by your concluding suggestion that challenges to the criminalization of scientific research could be perceived as a First Amendment matter. Could you elaborate that a little bit? What would be the nature of the legal debate that might emerge from that? And are you aware of any actionable efforts along those lines that are being made?
The question had to do with the First Amendment argument for the protection of scientific research, and asked first if I could elaborate, and second if I know of any action or precedents that would further it. Let me start by saying that there is no way, none, that the current Supreme Court would ever buy this argument, but that is, of course, what law professors are about, is to create arguments that nobody would accept. So the First Amendment of the United States guarantees that your right to free speech will not be abridged by the government. And then with the gloss of cases, except in cases where there is really a manifest harm to be avoided, the classic con fire in the theater, but really kind of the incitement to riot, right? So there's some speech that we can regulate, but by and large, we're very tolerant. And the theory is that more speech is better than less, that speech is an outlet for political statements that might otherwise be funneled into violent action and civil, you know, unrest, and also that the free speech approach actually allows ideas to be tested and theories to be challenged, and that ultimately truth or wisdom will emerge from this cacophony, right? In addition, we have a long history of cases that have said that speech is more than just the words out of somebody's mouth or the words that they write on paper. It can also be actions that are intended to express a viewpoint. So, for example, if I wear a t-shirt that has a picture of the American eagle with its neck being twisted, right? And it's intended to convey the message, because that was the t-shirt that we made after the Office of Technology Assessment was killed, and that was intended to convey an opposition to the decision to destroy that agency. The wearing of the t-shirt is protected, right? It's why we have these profound debates about the burning of the flag, which is, in fact, about expressive conduct, which is highly offensive to many people, but is clearly intended to convey a message of frustration, anger, whatever, with the current government. So the question then becomes, can scientific research ever be understood as intended to convey a message? Now, most scientific research absolutely is not. You know, all of the lab experiments that we all did in high school, most of the lab experiments going on here on campus, are not intended to convey any kind of political message. They are simply an exploration of science. Every once in a while, though, you do an experiment that so fundamentally challenges a political or religious or cultural notion that it is conveying a message, whether it's intended to or not. It's conveying the message that some things aren't so sacred that they can't be explored. The very act of exploring it is, in fact, a defiance of certain kinds of religious or cultural scriptures. But that's still not enough, because it has to be intended to convey a message. It's not enough to just happen to convey a message. And there are a couple of scientists that have been quoted as saying that they are doing this research because they want to disprove the existence of God. All right, I think you were like, oh my goodness. But that's my point. If they are saying that and they're shocking you, that to me is the beginning of the argument for why it does in fact need to be protected. Now, is anybody trying this? There's like 3 articles in all of the law review literature and one federal case that talk about this, and they are often running on some very highly kind of technical arguments about the way in which the First Amendment has already been interpreted. I don't know that they've gone at it exactly the same way I have. I certainly haven't elaborated enough to publish in a long piece, but whether it is defensible as a matter of constitutional law, I'm not sure. Probably not. Whether it is defensible as an argument at a purely political level, I think is a more difficult question to answer. And I like to think that people come to believe that no matter how much they fear or resent certain areas of research, that they nonetheless should protect its legality. I saw a couple of hands shoot up when I said that the researcher said she wanted to prove the non-existence of God. Yes.
I don't have much to say, except the analogy you have with nuclear power in the Navy is the same kind of a problem. Why don't we have nuclear power? Because somebody said, oh, that's a bad thing to do. And it's been given to the public, but the public has been true.
So the comment, without the precise language, was that there are strong analogies here to the debates around nuclear power, which was also given to the public and also squashed in many cases. Although one might argue that in nuclear power, the argument focused more on risk assessment than on something fundamental about the nature of the universe. Oppenheimer's comment, I am become death, notwithstanding, right? I mean, I appreciate, though, that the sheer power of it caused people to pause and go, oh my goodness, what have we done?
Everybody else is we're behind.
I don't know how we go till what time? Is it 1:30 or? Okay, so we've got a few more minutes. Way in the back. The question had to do with whether the new Wisconsin Institutes for Discovery are connected to Jamie Thompson and stem cell research. The answer is that the Wisconsin Institutes, plural, for Discovery consist of 2 separate entities. One is the Wisconsin Institute, singular, for Discovery, which will be a public-private partnership And the second is the Mortgage Institute for Research, which is being funded entirely with private monies and was kickstarted by a, I think it was $50 million donation from John Mortgage at Cisco Systems. These two separate entities will occupy a common space on University Avenue and will become the center for a variety of interdisciplinary teams. The precise way in which they'll function is still being worked out, but the Wisconsin Institute for Discovery, the public-private portion, has already been approved as a center, with its concept being that there'll be five or so scientific teams, each one linked by a theme. That is, each one will be one thematic area. They'll be led by somebody who's a current faculty member. There'll be some money for recruitment of additional faculty within that theme, and they will then be physically housed there to do their research, although they will also be faculty members of the campus. The Mortgage Institute for Research plan is still evolving, although there too I think we're likely to wind up with something like a series of discrete thematic groups, right, which will pursue interdisciplinary research. People ask what the difference is between the two, because so far they sound the same, and the primary difference is that Mortgage, being purely private, excuse me, will be it'll be nimbler. It can hire people, fire people, buy things more quickly than anybody under the state system, and it can change its mission without having to go through the university process for a center approval and center modification. But in many ways, they have a very common mission. Jamie Thompson has been selected to lead one of the five or six teams that will be physically housed at the Mortgage Institute on the private side. So he will lead one, but there will be four others or so, and the topics haven't been precisely decided, but it's likely that there will be one on bioinformatics, for example. There might be one that's more related to engineering. It's not yet completely clear. They're recruiting an executive director for Mortgage, and they, of course, want to have the executive director have a role in shaping the nature of the research. And because John and Tasha Mortgage have been quite clear about their preferences for how their money is used, there's also a very strong commitment to including a heavy dose of ethics, law, policy, history, arts, all of the arts and humanities and social sciences at the Mortgage Institute, in order to allow this institute, both for the scientists there and for the community at large on the campus, to help people appreciate science in its larger cultural context. The question was, how can you be involved in something like that? I presume you mean in the construction of the mission, et cetera, right?
Or the funding.
Or the funding. Yes! Okay, so first, let's talk. The Mortgage Institute does have somebody who is playing point named Laura Heisler, and they do have a board of trustees, and the chair of the board for the moment is Carl Gabranson, who is also the head of WARP. So between Laura and Carl, we have the two people that one might approach directly to talk about their vision for the Mortgage and where they are in that process and what might be a useful interaction with investors. For the Wisconsin Institute for Discovery, which is the public-private portion, the interim director is Marcia Seltzer, who is also the director of the Wasteman Center and the chair of the Chancellor Search Committee. So if you want to get in touch with Marcia, I suggest that you make it very clear you want to talk about money, because I don't think anybody else has a prayer of getting through these days. She is a busy, busy woman. I'm sorry, I apologize. I think we've just run out of time. That's fantastic, Gail. Thank you. This is an old, old contact from law school. Let me just repeat it for the web, okay? What Gail Holmes was saying is that Laura Heisler from the Mortgage Institute for Research will be speaking to the Wisconsin Retirement Association May 6th. Information can be gotten from the association. And I'll also just make a point that I believe it's May 3rd. Laura Heisler and the Mortgage Institute will be collaborating with the Center for the Humanities on a public forum called Bridging the Two Cultures, which is specifically about ways to bridge the cultures of science and the humanities. Happy to hang out up here if there are questions that I didn't get a chance to answer, and I thank you again for your attention.
Thank you for joining us for this installment of the Bascom Hill Society Showcase Series podcast. For more information on this and other topics, please visit the University of Wisconsin Foundation homepage at www.uwfoundation.wisc.edu.